You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is the CRM Archaeology Podcast. It's the show where we pull back the veil of cultural resources management, archaeology, and discuss the issues that everyone is concerned about. Welcome to the podcast.
Welcome to CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 322. And today joining me is Renee in Colorado.
How's it going, everyone?
Andrew in Southern California.
Hey, everyone. What's up?
And Bill in Northern California.
Good morning.
And I'm sitting here in Central California. Beautiful, but very rainy Santa Barbara.
Wondering about that. The rains are, it actually rained up here even.
Oh, did it? Yeah. Right. It's been nonstop for days, and it's some, you know, the atmospheric river. What did we call it when we were kids? I don't know. But anyway, rain. We called
storm.
It rain.
Yeah, rain. Storm. It used to just be called rain.
Yeah.
I love all these new names. So anyway, we had, you know, I think this is a great topic anyway, but we did have a couple listeners that just kind of knocked on our door and said, hey, how about talking about the Section 106 hearing? And for those that are not aware, the Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources had a hearing on October 26th on Section 106. And they were talking about the efficacy of it. Just does it, you know, work well? They had three witnesses that testified. All were actually pretty great. Some much better than others. I mean, they were all three were great eyewitnesses, but for an archaeologist, in from an informative perspective of understanding Section 106 and its current impact and how it works, to me, the most informative was Dr. Chris Merritt. He is from the State Historic Preservation Office of Utah. That makes sense because the senator that is in charge of the committee is Senator Lee from Utah. But either way, even if he had not been, I think he would have been an excellent choice for, you know, being an eyewitness and providing some insight on Section 106. So just to give you some background for those that are not, you know, into politics, this committee is chaired by Mike Lee on the Republican side. And there are 11 Republican members from the states of Wyoming, Idaho, Montana, Arkansas, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alaska, and North Dakota. And then the ranking member is Martin Heinrich from New Mexico. And that I have a feeling he's the one that invited Stephen Concho, who is the THPO for the Pueblo of Acoma in New Mexico. He's also a board member for the National Association of THPOs. And then finally, our third eyewitness was Andy McDonald. He is the environmental compliance manager for the Montana Dakota Utilities Company. And so those three eyewitnesses, really their testimony, it started off with, it was an introduction by both Mike Lee, Senator Mike Lee, and the ranking member, Senator Martin Heinrich. But then we had these testimonies, which we'll put the link. The linker is in the show notes. And if you click on that link, you'll see there are three transcriptions of their testimonies, Chris Merritt's, Stephen Concho's, and Andy McDonald's. So if you're better at reading than listening, there they are for you. So the themes are excellent. I would say, please watch this hearing. It is amazing primer for understanding Section 106 and the practical use of Section 106 in our business CRM. You get the perspective, of course, a utility, so an entity that has to go through the Section 106 process and how it impacts them. You get the perspective of a tribal historic preservation officer. So from the tribal perspective, how Section 106 includes them and how effectively it includes them. And then, of course, the state historic preservation officer. The only thing you're not getting is the actual professionals that have to, that are consultants for applicants throughout the process. So, but I think that Chris actually from the Utah SHPO does a really good job of explaining that as well. So anyway, I'm going to open it up. I highly recommend you watch the hearing, and there will be so much, especially if you're new in your career or you're a student, there will be a lot that will go over your head. But I think this is something that could be watched over and over again, and you're going to continue to learn things. So it is an eye-opening experience, especially if all you listen to is the news. This really gives you a good understanding of how Section 106 is practiced and the blame game that happens.
Yeah.
It really does not have a whole lot of merit. There's a lot of discussion about that. Does the environmental review process have issues? Absolutely. But there is so much blame on the cultural and the tribal portions of the review that is unfair. And I think Chris does a really good job at demonstrating that. The reason I think, and then I'll shut up and let everybody else talk, but the reason I think that happens is because the environmental review process has been hijacked. It's been hijacked by nasty actors, and in my opinion, mostly the people that litigate projects, and they use cultural and natural and tribal resources as a weapon. So Section 106 has been weaponized. There are many that use it to argue whether or not a project should move forward when they really do not care about cultural resources or natural resources. It is the two, and I'm putting tribal resources in with cultural, but cultural and natural are the two resources that are not as objective. There's a lot of subjectivity to what is a resource, what is significant, what are adverse effects. And because of that, it's easy to, you know, for litigation, it's easy to find little holes to go after. And you see this in, you know, CEQA in California all the time. You know, you have these entities that litigate. And, you know, a lot of litigation happens with unions. Unions litigate projects all the time to get what they want. And it's not that they care about cultural resources or natural resources, but those are the easiest, sometimes the easiest loopholes to find. So with that, I'll open it up to everyone else.
Yeah, I mean, I hear you on the hijacking part, but my question that when I watched the entire thing was, why did it even exist? Because I thought that during, you know, as soon as the new regime came in, they immediately said, all our energy is a total emergency and that we can't really worry about any legislation. We just need to go for it and we need to create energy, because I think that a lot of times, you know, these rules are just like by people who don't really understand how processes work. And they envision that we can just like put a pipe in the ground and gasoline just comes out or something like that. Or that, you know, we can just brush the dust off and coal immediately glows into electricity. And so the mandate that we're in an energy emergency came out and they said, you know, well, all these things are exempt from every environmental law. Let's just make every hole as big as possible, hog out all the coal. You know, it's going to immediately turn into power. And there we go. Like the emergency is going to be solved. And that happened way back. You know, we talked about it, that we already had a episode 306 on the executive mm-hmm. orders and their impacts on archaeology. And, you know, spoiler alert, it didn't actually impact archaeology as badly as folks thought, as far as the way that the law works, but it did impact hiring a lot, because now nobody knows whether a project's going to happen, since nobody knows what's going to happen next, since you can't know what the rules are going to be 45 minutes after they say them. So those constant changes in the rules have affected CRM, but the mechanics of how the process works, it seems like it's still intact. So when I saw that this was coming up, I was wondering, why did they even have this hearing?
Well, I think they had it because there has been a theme with this administration to look at the workings of all these types of processes. So they're looking at whether or not these are efficient, if they should exist at all. Obviously, you know, Section 106 is not going away, despite the sky is falling rants of some people. But there has been a theme, and this is not new to this administration. There's, you know, every administration, and they should look at processes and see if they're efficient. I mean, that is the job of the politicians that, and as long as they're actually doing it and they're not just talking about it and fighting about it. But I do think that, and Chris Merritt actually talks about it, the SHPO from Utah. He says there are issues with the system. There are reasons why people do have complaints, and not all the complaints are invalid. They are valid. And this is from somebody who is having to actually practice the Section 106. So I think, you know, there's maybe a little bit of understanding. Maybe we should explain a little bit to the listeners that, so you have Section 106 is federal, right? But there is part of Section 106, it has, as Chris Merritt talks about, a federalist approach. And that means that it is not run from a federal viewpoint, is actually run by the states. So the states have their ability to practice 106, Section 106, in the manner that they see fit. So, you know, my perspective as a CRM professional, I feel is pretty unique in the fact that I work in over 30 states. And so I have the unique perspective of being able to work with 30 different ways of practicing Section 106. And they are very different. Every state is different. And I don't think that's a big deal. I think that's the beauty of the system. That's the beauty of the federalist approach. Because, and Chris Merritt and others actually bring this up, each state has a different issue to deal with. You know, their landscape is different. Chris mentioned, you know, there's a difference between, so Murkowski, Senator Murkowski from Alaska, she spoke on some of the issues that were happening up there. And Chris said, you know, listen, there's, you know, I can look for miles and miles on the landscape. In Alaska, you can't, for the most part. So that's why an approach to practicing Section 106 is going to be different in Utah than it would be in Alaska. And that's why that's a good thing.
Yeah.
But because of the fact there's differences, what his call for that I understood, one of the things that he says is that the framework of Section 106 and how it is practiced in each state, maybe states need to learn from each other. And also, we need to have a better glossary of what these terms like an APE, an area of potential effect, is. And so I think I think he's bang on with that. That just having the experience with several different states, there are some that actually I'm thrilled don't have anything really set up all that. it goes so smoothly. But sometimes not having, you know, it is all based on the officer the officer that's helping you through that process. So you could have one project that goes smoothly through, let's say, you know, one state's SHPO office, and then you have another project in the same state that gets held up and you don't know why. So,
well, yeah, I mean, it's a complicated system. And I first of all, I think Chris did an excellent job of, I mean, he just did an excellent job. It was like the person like lived for this. It was just an excellent, you know, defense of cultural resources. I appreciated it. And I think that like the biggest takeaway that I really hope that the folks that were there in that hearing came away with was, this is a complicated process. You need to start thinking about what you're going to do in advance and make sure that your people actually understand the full range of compliance that they have to be, you know, responsible for, and that they need to have open communication. Like, whatever happens. The example that you were talking about from Alaska was, you know, discussion about having to dig shovel probes, and the person clearly thought that was too many. And so I was shaking my head like, well, you have this long line that's going through territory where no one knows if there's any archaeology, because the person also mentioned that they haven't surveyed a lot of Alaska and that there is just open land where we don't really know what's there. And they were saying, well, there's just a whole bunch of shovel probes and that would have taken forever, and therefore we couldn't do the project. I'm like, yeah, you should have actually scoped and known that you would have to do shovel probes, like, before you even put in the grant to do the project, right? Like, you should have known that this is what you do for cultural resources before you were like, yeah, man, let's just dig a trench. And so it seemed to me like, once again, they don't really understand the whole process. They didn't know what they were supposed to do. And then when the archaeologist said, oh, yeah, you know what? We're going to just do shovel probes. It's common. Because what she mentioned in that is something that I've been on probe surveys where we did hundreds of probes, man. And not even for something important like a fiber optic pipeline. We did 400 or 500 probes for like a subdivision development, because that's what that state required. And the developer was not saying, oh, that's too many probes, we can't do it. They were just like, yeah, well, just make sure that you find all the sites so that we don't get surprised. They just internalized it, because in the state where I was working, they understood that was something that you have to do. And it also seems like the person like somehow didn't know that was what's done in their state, and then comes to DC and says that they were startled and that's just way too many. And I think that Chris Merritt did a good job of saying, I don't know how things work in your state, but, you know, given the conditions, like, that's what you need to plan for.
Right. I think, you know, I have a perspective on that part. I think you're right, but let's take this discussion to the next segment. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 322.
We are talking about the Senate committee hearing on Section 106 that occurred in October, late October, just a few weeks ago. And Bill made a good point. We were talking about the interaction between Senator Murkowski from Alaska, who had brought up a frustration she had regarding a pipeline that had gone in, all the shovel test probes that had to happen as a part of that project. And she just thought it was onerous. It just didn't make sense to her. And Chris came back, and Chris Merritt from SHPO in Utah came back and was very pragmatic. He's a very pragmatic individual. And I've talked to him, and I know Renee has too. He's terrific. I'll tell you, out of all, I have some favorite SHPO offices. I'm not going to say all of them, but one of them is the Utah office. They are amazing. Every individual I've worked with in that office is wonderful. They're very accessible. They explain things. They take the time. They don't act like they're too busy or too important to explain things or to work with you and find strategic ways to move forward on a project. So I just think they're terrific. But Chris had, you know, mentioned, like we said, about, you know, different states have need to have different approaches because they have a different landscape. And so, you know, Bill mentioned the SCPs. You're absolutely right. I think it was a cheap shot. It was an easy thing to say. And, you know, politicians do that, right? They just pick. Yeah. They cannot be an expert on everything. Some senators.
Well, I would argue they're not an expert on really anything.
Yes,
just
true,
a guy that, we, you know.
You're right.
Right. Because
right,
the actual
right,
expert would know that they don't know enough to be a leader. And exactly. So they would step back. But someone who doesn't know what they're talking about is the prime candidate right. To be a leader.
So the issue to me is that this, again, speaks to the weaponization of Section 106. And the cheap shots. I mean, it's just an easy thing to do is to blame Section 106, to blame archaeologists, to say, we're the stopgap, we're the issue. And, or, you know, the biologists, the bugs and bunnies. You know, I work for an engineering company. I hear that a lot. Oh, the bugs and bunnies. And I'm like, oh my goodness. So it's an easy thing to blame. And it doesn't help solve anything.
Yeah.
Because I do believe that Section 106 does not, Section 106 doesn't need work, but we do need to have a more programmatic approach to it. We do need to have some more, like make a glossary, like Chris said, have some more definitive understandings of the terms that are used in the Section 106 process. I do think it is right now too subjective. I agree with him on that. I think we can't get it too mechanized because then it's not going to be flexible to each state. But I do think that there are some improvements that can be made. But as far as the STPs go, I do think that I have seen plenty of projects where STPs are done for the sake of STPs. And they're not necessary all the time. And I think I have sympathy for the regulatory side of things because they don't want to get sued. There's people that are going to litigate on both sides. You have the applicants that are going to litigate. You have these environmental watchdogs that are going to litigate. You have entities, like I mentioned in the first segment, you have unions that are going to weaponize cultural natural resources to get what they want for their members. And so I do think there's not a one size fits all, and that STPs always have to be a part of the evaluation process. And so I think, you know, I'm not demonizing STPs, but I am saying that there needs to be a little bit more thought. And Chris brought up a really good approach to that. And this is one of my favorite approaches, is the programmatic approach. Let's look at projects. Let's see what their impact are and look at sectors. Look at sectors of projects and say, okay, is there a programmatic approach that we can take to this type of project and have that set up ahead of time? That will definitely be a more efficient way of looking at things. So, Bill, you had something to say.
Yeah, no, I agree. And that was mentioned in there. Programmatic agreements between agencies and the SHPO would streamline things quite a bit more. And, you know, the other thing too that was not mentioned, I think that folks did a great job of defending Section 106 as it is while acknowledging there needs to be changes. But like you mentioned before, other parties that are, you know, have an inroad into it, they're the ones who insert themselves and make things complicated. One simple example is just folks within your company or the client organization, their own personal agendas and also lack of understanding what's going on, right? Because I have seen several times projects get delayed over health and safety handbooks that we created and gave them to the company when they got a new occupational hygienist in who decided that whatever we had done on page 19 was deficient according to X, you know, code, and that we needed to stop all work and then remedy our health and safety plan, right? And so then some other client from some other office is sending emails like, why aren't your guys out in the field surveying? Well, because we have to run this past our legal department and our health and safety person because page 19 had a bad paragraph. And come to find out, it was like misquoting a county code that someone else identified, right? There's also been a million like hurry up and wait situations. Those also cause problems. And so when these folks who were advocating for drill, baby, drill were, you know, saying that we need this energy right this minute in the hearing, they weren't acknowledging that their own companies are such a cluster that they cause the problems that then are passed on and it's easy to blame it on us.
Yeah, good point, Bill. Yep.
Yeah, no. Okay, so here's my dissertation on this. So I have a couple thoughts, and really, I really enjoyed watching this. So the setup is, at the very beginning of this, we talked about how it's rainy in California. So my Saturday class, I couldn't do anything outside, right? Because it's raining. So I had everyone Zoom in, and I had my class watch this hearing together, right, in real time. And Heather came on, and Renee came on too, and like all of us watch it together. And I have to recommend anyone in CRM who hasn't seen this, definitely just watch it. Because, you know, we can piddle around in our own little CRM world, but love or hate the government, it's like, that's where real stuff is going down. You know, like we can be like, why did they have this hearing? But they're having the hearing, you know? And I thought it was a huge eye opener. And I thought it actually made me proud of America. Because there were actually a bunch of congresspeople there who were kind of sort of trying to get things done. I thought the people who looked the worst were the people on the extremes. Like you had, what's his name, Tom Cotton or whatever, the extreme, like on the extreme right, just talking about
Yosemite Sam stuff.
Yeah. The other guy who was like, oh, just what about the radical environmentalists? What about the radical environmentalists? And he just looked like an idiot.
Yeah.
Right. On the flip side, on the left, I got to say, my own guy from California, he was just like, so, yeah, he was like, so what you're seeing is it needs to be meaningful. It needs to be meaningful.
I was like, meaningful.
You're saying nothing, you know?
Can you pick the most subject? Yeah. That's the one thing I really am not crazy about, tribal consultation, because I agree it should be meaningful. Absolutely.
Of course.
What the heck does meaningful mean?
But it's kind of like what Bill said at the top. It's like some of these guys don't know anything about it. And the worst offenders are the ones who just come to virtue signal and grandstand for their side, just wasting time.
But, like Heidrich actually crying, fake crying. I'm like, I was like, are you serious?
Yeah, the crying part, I was like, suck that in, brother. Come on, dude. Oh my gosh. But what gave me hope and I thought was so great was the huge percentage of those people were in the middle. They were just listening. Yes. They were trying to come up with like real, you know, like, how about this? How about this? And I was like, hey, that's how government works when it actually works.
Yes.
So I really enjoyed it. I was really happy my students got to see it, you know, and while who knows where it ultimately goes, I was impressed in the most general sense.
I really, again, suggest that everybody watch this, but there are a few themes that I wanted to discuss and get everybody's kind of input and thought on. So the themes that I saw, there were so many. I'm sure if I watch this again, I'd find more. But so the ones that I wrote down were, first of all, they say limited funding equals slow response. So I understand that. I didn't think that was a prevailing theme from my experience. I would say SHPOs are pretty great with their with making the required 30-day response. And with everything that has happened and the complaints that people have, now things slip through the cracks and things take longer and maybe they take the 30 days. And for those that don't practice or don't have like a insider knowledge of that Section 106. So when the projects that you're working on and you're doing these STPs, the managers or the CRM managers are writing up these reports and then those get turned into the SHPO and SHPO then reviews those reports and they have 30 days to respond to that report. Now, if they see an issue with the report and they do not think that it meets the threshold of what they are expecting and that they can't make a concurrence decision, meaning they agree with the findings or they don't agree with the findings and they need you to go back and get more information or you don't have enough information, your analysis was not conducted with enough data, it gets turned back and now you have another 30 days. Well, first you have to fix it, however long that takes. And then you submit it again and the SHPO has another 30 days. So this is where it does get protracted. The process gets protracted and a smart and a knowledgeable, experienced CRM professional knows that you need to interact with the SHPO ahead of time and understand exactly what they're looking for this project. So you're working as a team and you connect with them. And some SHPOs have this setup where they require a research plan and a work research design and a work plan ahead of time so that they make sure that CRM consultants are doing something in the proper way. And so all these processes can quicken the review time. But the limited funding, I thought that was interesting. There was a really good, you know, small, short discussion on the funding. And it was eye-opening to some of the senators. So, you know, Chris was talking about what is the funding that he has. So there's the funding that goes to SHPOs has different elements. There's like three tiers, and I'm not going to go into that. We could do a whole podcast on that. But it has the three tiers. There's the determinations are how big, how much landmass you have in your state, what's your population in your state, how many landmarks, NRHP eligible or listed resources do you have? That also takes, which I think is interesting, but we'll talk about that in another podcast. And then there's, you can actually, I think, write in and provide more information. And that third tier, you can get some more funding based on your pleas for funding, right? But there is a form, there's three formulas, I believe, that go into that. For those shippos that are listening, if I'm incorrect, I apologize, but this is just an overarching idea so that people understand. There is a formula that goes into how much money each state gets. So the states are, it's not across the board, each state gets the same. There is a certain amount that's allocated for shippos, and right off the top, each get the same amount. And then your formulas for the rest, they get a different amount based on those different traits that I was talking about. But the THPOs don't. THPOs, so in comparison, Chris said 60% of his funding comes from federal grants and 40% comes from state. So he gets about, I think it was somewhere around 1.8 million funding. And when you look at, that's not a lot of money. But in comparison, Stephen Concho from the Pueblo of Coma, he said they get $100,000 in grants. So, you know, of course, gasp, how come the tribes get less? And the one point that was brought up is that you will always have the same amount of shippos, but increasingly there's been more federally recognized tribes. So the tribes that get the money are the tribes for the THPOs have to be federally recognized. So we have a lot of California recognized tribes, but that's different than a federally recognized tribe. So a federally recognized tribe, those tribes are becoming more and more. There's 200, I think he said, THPOs that get funding, and there's 59 SHPOs that get funding. That 59 will always stay at 59, but the 200 will grow every year, likely. So that funding, there's some things that need to change. My personal opinion is that you have some tribes, and Andrew, thank you. It should have been Acoma, excuse me. I apologize for mispronouncing the tribal name.
No, it's Acoma.
Acoma.
I don't work. I'm so sorry. Acoma tribe. Okay, so.
No worries. It's all right.
No, this will be your last show, Heather. I'm pretty sure.
No, it's always best to correct mistakes, man. It's always best to correct mistakes.
I genuinely apologize. But as far as the funding goes, I really think that, you know, the SHPOs do not have other options to get monies. The THPOs do, and not all THPOs do, but those THPOs that have a large amount of funding from casinos, from pipelines, gas and oil, I really think there should be a sliding scale for the tribes. And that's only fair for those tribes that don't have that income, that revenue coming in. They definitely need to have more funding, for sure. But I don't know if that's going to come from the government, because I don't know if that's really sustainable. What should happen, and maybe it's a pool that comes in, that the tribes that do have these monies pool into one funding pool, and then it gets taken out of that. But anyway, that's just a thought off the top of my head.
Well, I think the fastest way to increase revenue is to take all the earmarks off of the oil and gas leases that are supposed to be for the Historic Preservation Fund, and actually fund all of the money that come from those oil and gas leases. Because right now, it's the Historic Preservation Fund comes from certain oil and gas leases through the federal government. But that money over time has earmarks of other programs and other stuff that's coming from that. So like the SHPOs don't get all of the money from the oil and gas leases. Like it says in 1976 or whatever, when the funding was supposed to come to the National Park Service, it was supposed to come through these different oil and gas funds. Well, those have earmarks for other programs that siphon off some of the money before it even gets to the SHPOs. So before we ask tribes to pay for more, we can always just try to stop the leeches from draining off of the fund that's supposed to go for this program anyway.
Agreed. I don't think that was just off the top of my head, but I do think that it could be a combination. There are maybe, and again, I'm not well read on what are all the programs that siphon off money off of the gas. And
yeah, I don't know them either.
But, and of course, we don't want to be like the politicians that just are speaking without knowledge, but I do think there's a better way, and the THPOs definitely need more money. And some tribes can fund the THPOs themselves, but for those tribes that can't do that, they need help. There's too many tribes that are doing this work pro bono, and that is that it's just not going to get done correctly.
It's wrong.
Yeah, it's not right.
Well, it's also wrong because they're doing it to, you know, save heritage sites for their people, even though they're underfunded and underpaid. Meanwhile, you know, there's the clients who are drilling away. They're not doing anything for no money, right? And instead, they're freaking out about having to spend any money on what someone else is doing for borderline free. So, yeah, that's a super predatory system that I think should not exist.
Yeah, we hear that in California, too, for CEQA and AB 52 and SB 18. So with that, we're going to go to the next segment. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 322.
We are talking about the Senate committee hearing on Section 106 today. And I'm really curious. I want to hear what Renee has to say. Renee, you have some experience. Would you call yourself like mid-career archaeologist? And so you're the one who's really doing the work that Section 106, the work in the field and desk, I'm sure as well. What do you think about all this?
Oh, that's a loaded question, Heather. Thank you.
You have the whole segment. Go for it.
No. Okay. So I really appreciate this hearing. I thought my hat's off to everyone, regardless of what side you're on. Chris did a wonderful job really explaining what we do. And Mr. Concho, he really put it out like what the tribe does and why it's important in a cultural landscape of protecting history and their own history. But ultimately, it really kind of opens up the discussion of like Section 106 is the most expensive part of the NHPA process. It is. It's slow for the identification process. But Section 106, why we go out there, it gets triggered, right? That's what it, like, that's why we go out there and to identify and process. And yes, we're slow, but you want a good job. That's what we do. But ultimately, I think on both sides, I think this was a big victory on either way you look at it. It really like it. I think one of the main concepts, or just in general, I think everyone can agree that at some point in that whole discussion, that history is worth protecting, you know, because we look at the White House, people got all crazy about it, but that's a whole different discussion. We can look at that. But like either way, I think for preservation, for us going forward. I mean, Section 106 in itself, people say they understand it, but do they really? And I think Chris put that out there saying, hey, this is what it is. And each state is different, correct? You go to each state, they have their own criteria of what an archaeological site is, why we do it, what to record, all that stuff. But I think it really opens up the discussion to understand what the Section 106 process is. And having Andrew students like listen to it, good job. My hat's off to you on that for having that class for them to watch it. It really gives, you're welcome. Having them have that like idea of what we do as their young careers are going forward, it's like, this is what we have to deal with. And this is legislation. It's always changing. And this is the discussion. And, you know, we always have that backlash of, oh, you're just an archaeologist. You're here to stop our projects. That's not true. In CRM, we want to do the best job possible, but moving the project forward so we can have, you know, a completion. It's not like, oh, well, we're going to stop this because, you know, it's an important discovery. And we have to understand that we cannot save everything as CRM archaeologists. We write our, you know, our recommendations, our NRHPAs, and that's what we have. That's what as our contract. But ultimately, when you say Section 106, people think they're experts on it. In reality, they're not. And I agree on the last segment that we should have a document that really has different, like, this is what the APE means. This is what, let's use right away. Like the row, what does that mean? What's an undertaking? What's an adverse effect? Just having all those different like terminologies to people to really understand that. And 106 is not really discussed too much. So it's like when people say they're experts on it, it's like, are you? So ultimately, I think this was a good, excellent, like, hearing. I think both sides are understanding each other. And ultimately, I think it's just communication. People just need to discuss more of what they want, what they openly want, what the client wants. So my pedestal moment. Thank you.
Thank you, Renee. Excellent insights. I wanted to piggyback off of something that you said as far as the glossary. You know, we talked about that. I mentioned it a few times, but you know, just to give you some insight into how that was brought up. So one example was the APE. And so, you know, we have two different types. We have indirect and direct APE, just for those. And where the direct APE isn't usually as difficult to identify or as, you know, argued, but where you do have sometimes an issue is in the indirect. So direct is more the physical, but the indirect is visual, atmospheric, and auditory. And that is, I've been on some projects, you know, wind projects where turbines are in the way of the solstice, the view shed during solstice in California for the Santa Ynez Chumash. They have a cave that they look in one direction at the solstice, and a turbine where it was originally planned was going to be right in the view shed of that. And so the turbine was moved and some of the turbines were made shorter so that the view shed was not impacted. And that was actually a really good functional way of solving the problem. It worked great. But sometimes these more subjective ideas of the APE is where things get slowed down. And so having something a little bit more defined, I think, was what Chris was, and hopefully I'm not, you know, mis-explaining, you know, what his perspective was. But there was one thing I really liked his approach of, there are three aspects of Section 106 that really needs to be looked at. And so we can say, and this, you know, politicians are, you know, they're experts at one thing, and that is obfuscation and gumming up the works and just, you know, doing nothing, like saying, oh, we need to fix something, but then never putting anything forward to actually do that. And so
yeah,
there were three aspects that Chris kind of broke up and said, these are some areas that need to be looked at. He said Section 106 has three components: the funding, the regulatory, and the procedural. And those are the three areas that need to be looked at. And I totally agree with him. And hopefully I'm not, again, misrepresenting what he said. But that was what I got from it. And so the procedural, we've already talked about that. That's coming from, you know, getting some more objective, you know, definitions of these terms that are used. The regulatory side is the actual practice and how, I think some of the regulatory side is how that is impacted by lawfare, meaning, you know, lawsuits from NGOs, from all different types of entities. And one person, actually, I can't remember who it was. But one of the senators brought up the fact that, you know, a lot of these projects, they get multiple bites at the apple, as he said. So if one lawsuit and one, what they consider a loophole in or an issue with the finding, if that doesn't work, then they can go at it from another angle. And that's what really slows down. It's the lawfare that slows down these projects. It's not Section 106. And that's what I think really, to me, won the day in this hearing, was that, to me, it was very clear. Section 106 is not the issue here, really. It is the weaponization of Section 106.
Well, and also, yeah. I think Chris did a good job of pointing out that SHPO's turned this thing around in like 20 days, and yes, they have up to 30. And so I don't remember projects that we went like wildly over, you know, our time, right? Because time is money in CRM. So if you're going over, you're going over budget, and that's bad.
He was saying some of them, they turn them around in 10 days. And I agree, they do. But it's like I was saying before, it's not necessarily the review period. They do get back to you within the 30 days of requirement. It is the fact, like I said before, if you don't have the consultants working with the SHPOs to make sure that they are presenting and they're providing a report and they're doing work that is going to be accepted by the SHPO, if you do that ahead of time, so that when you do have your findings, that you have a high likelihood of having concurrence to your findings, that's what's key. What slows things down are two two aspects. If you have not worked and strategized with the SHPO to make sure that the work that you're doing, the work plan you're doing is sufficient, then that your report is going to get kicked back for another review and you're going to have to fix it. So that's where things get slowed down. If you do your work, you're told, okay, I have to do this. You do your work, you submit your report, and that report comes back with, you know, within the 30 days, and you've done everything that SHPO expected and your finding is appropriate according to the SHPO, you have concurrence right away and they can move forward. Section 106 has been completed. Well, not totally, but it's the hard part of it has been completed. So that is where I think things need to be improved. And that's the procedural part.
I agree with you. And I think that's one of the problems with some, I'm not poo-pooing some CRM firms at all. It is our duty. It is our ethical component to be like, hey, we do the best work we can to make it complete. It's our due diligence. That's why we're getting paid to do this. So I think instead of like, let's rush to get all this done, make sure you do your work properly and then you won't have this problem.
Right. Excellent point, Renee. And also though, walk into your work knowing that SHPO agrees with your work plan, right? Don't just say, I have to do this. And so this is my pet peeve with our discipline. I've got news for everybody. And this is going to be, it's true, but I think it's going to be controversial. We are not one thing. We are not preservationists. If you are in CRM and you consider yourself a preservationist, I think you're in the wrong business. There is a place for preservationists, but it's not CRM. Our job is to ethically do the work that Section 106 requires, or if you are doing your work under some state regulation, whatever that regulation requires. Your job is to follow the research designs, the work plans that are set up ahead of time and that are signed off by the regulators, and to make sure that you are doing the work in an ethical manner. Now, when you find something, and that's where people get confused, because the laws, whether it's a state law or it's a federal law, talks about preservation. Yes, our job is about, if we find something, the ideal is to preserve, if we find something that's significant to the understanding of our national history and previous to the national history for the Native American history, yes, that needs to be preserved. At least we need to do everything we can to preserve it if it's feasible. And if it's not, then we mitigate. But our job is not to preserve everything. And that's where people get tripped up, especially in the beginning, where, and I think some of it's unethical. Some of it is, you know what? It's easier as a CRM professional, if I get a project and the SHPO says, we would need you to do 1,000 SDPs. I mean, they're talking about hundreds of SDPs. I've got projects. It's thousands of SDPs.
Yeah, man. I remember doing them where I did more than 100 myself in like 2 weeks or a week.
It's insane. So as a CRM professional on the state level for the SHPOs and for planners, let's say in California, they are going to give you the most conservative work plan possible. They're going to say, we need SCPs across the entire project site. Your job as a CRM professional is to really look at that strategy and say, does that make sense? Does it make sense to do SCPs in an area that has fill down 10 feet? So the SHPO may not know. That's your job as a CRM professional to look at it and say, wait a minute, it makes no sense for us to do an SDP in fill. That's stupid. Right? Or if you know that the entire project site, we had a recent project site in Texas, 3/4 of the project had already had STPs done. We didn't need to do STPs again. We only did it for the quarter that was left that had not been done. So it's your job as a CRM professional to understand the nuances of your project. The SHPOs don't have time to do that. And then to come back to the SHPO and say, listen, here, we have these circumstances for this project. How about we do this? for the work plan. But make sure you have a sign off from the SHPO and then you move forward. But that is not being done by some CRM professionals. There are lots of CRM professionals that are doing that properly, but the ones that aren't give us a bad name. And there are different reasons. Sometimes they just do not have the savvy or the understanding and they just do whatever a SHPO says. And they don't understand SHPO's just working with the information that they have. It's your job to give them the specific information about the project. Or the other thing is, we have lazy consultants that say, you know what? Hey, cha-ching, that's several less projects I have to go out and try to win because I just got a project that has 2,000 STPs that's going to keep me busy for a quarter of the year and take care of my, you know, Q1 revenue. That is wrong, but that does happen. I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear people say it doesn't happen. It absolutely does happen. And that gives us as a profession a black eye. It gives us, and it hurts the rest of us to give legitimacy to the work that we do.
Exactly. I'm sorry, Heather. I would have jumped in earlier, but I'm busy. I'm busy canceling you online just for the comments that you've said. So it's taken a while. I had to go on Twitter, you know. No, I totally agree. I love the idea that we're the sort of atom bomb of like, you know, we're not preservationists, but I totally get what you mean because it's ultimately true. I think that's such like this linchpin tipping point where it's like at the end of the day, you are a professional. Underline the term professional.
But in order to be scientific,
follow the law as is, yes, you know, for reasonable outcomes.
In order to be scientific, we cannot walk into something saying, I've got to find something to preserve. That is not
right.
Our place. No,
I've seen that so many times.
Yes, and I've gotten into this. I'm in this discipline because my heart wants to preserve. I want to preserve important things. But you know, one thing, one of your students said when we did this yesterday, they said and it's a common term, but I think it's good to remember, if everything is significant, nothing is significant. That we need to remember that. And we also need to remember that we can be our own worst enemies. If we're going around and saying that a can scatter is significant, or if we're saying every single lithic scatter is significant, it's not just, did you find maybe you found a lithic scatter and there's hundreds of lithic scatters that have already been identified, that have already been evaluated. And we have, and lots of data recovery has already occurred. Is, you know, part of the criteria that we're looking for when we're looking for what is a historic property, what is a significant resource, is does what we find, does it have the potential to add to our understanding of history or prehistory? That is key. That is something you need to understand. And if it's not going to add, not because it's not important. There's a difference between important and significant. If it's, it may be important, but it may not be significant because we already know. We already have the information.
Well, the only thing I'd like to add to that, though, is that in the case of the can scatter and the lithics, sometimes by law that meets the definition of an archaeological site, right? So then your question is, how many archaeological sites are you willing to say are not significant, right? Because it does set the precedent. You just got to be judicious. I hear you about some of the stuff, but you got to be judicious about it because it only takes one time of rejecting a can scatter for them to magically be like, okay, everything in Madera County, because in 2025, Bill said that's not significant. So we're just done with all those.
True. And that's where you have a multi-step process, right? So you can have a can scatter that you can say is significant, but you don't necessarily have to do a data recovery or some other kind of, you don't have to go that next level. You can monitor there. But if you already have enough information about that area and that's that resource, that can scatter that may contribute to the resource, right? May contribute to the significant resource. If it's not going to give you more information, then you don't need to take that next step of mitigation. You can monitor, but maybe you don't need to do data recovery. And that's all these, it's just so multifaceted.
It's correct. Like when you, like from a field perspective, Heather, like when I'm out there, I have a crew, right? And I sit there, I'm like, okay, I explain. It's all about education. When you're out there, you're always learning why this site is significant or not, why it falls under criterion D, why is it A, B, or C? all that stuff. And I think that has to be on the ground level too, and understand those different criterions of why it's significant and why it's not. We're going to make it eligible, not eligible. And it's more people that are just lazy. It's easier to say why it's not eligible or something like that. It's due diligence, like I said before, and common sense. But I'm not going to put every can scatter as significant, but each state has its own criteria of why, like, oh, it's just another can scatter. Oh, it's just this. As long as you can pose the argument of why it's significant or not, and you have SHPL concurrence, you're fine.
Yes, agreed.
Well, with that, I am going to say one more time, please watch this hearing. I really think that it would be helpful to anyone in the business, student, professional, seasoned professional. And, you know, the other thing is that this is not just something that we can sit back here. Right now, we are being armchair archaeologists, kind of. But I think that we can help SHPOs. There are ways we can help SHPOs, and the one way is making sure that you're looking at them as a team. They're not just, you know, from up high, giving you an edict, and then you move forward and do your thing, cross your fingers that what you provide is going to pass the muster with them. Look at them as a part of your team. And if you do that, you're going to make their job easier, you're going to make your job easier, and you're actually going to make us as a discipline look better, because that is going to smooth out the process. We should all be working together in order to ensure that Section 106 is exercised properly and as efficiently as it can. And with that, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you in the field.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.
See you guys next time.
Rock on, everyone.
That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.arcpodnet.com/CRMArcPodcast. Please comment and share anywhere you see the show. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website, or just email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Support the show and the network at arcpodnet.com/members. Get some swag and extra content while you're there. Send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about. The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.